denser regions of dark matter, like our own galaxy, and dark matter in these denser regions can annihilate, and the annihilation products can be high-energy standard model stuff that we can see. And at the end of last class, I finished up talking about, or I said all I wanted to say about high-energy photons from dark matter annihilation. And today, I want to talk about other kinds of high-energy particles you can produce from dark matter annihilation that we might be able to see. And these things are called generically cosmic rays. Sometimes the gamma rays are also called cosmic rays, but here I just mean cosmic rays. By cosmic rays, I mean other stuff. And by other stuff, I mean protons, antiprotons, electrons, positrons, and possibly neutrinos, or even deuterium or heavier nuclei. And the reason why I'm only talking about these states is that when the dark matter annihilates, typically this stuff has to travel a long way to get to us. And that means that the only thing that will get to us in the end is stuff that's stable. So the initial dark matter annihilation might not go to these channels, but whatever comes out of the dark matter annihilation will do whatever it does and end up as some combination of these plus photons. So we're going to think about cosmic rays that are that correspond to these stable particles. And the story here for computing the cosmic ray flux turns out to be a lot more complicated than for gamma rays. And the reason it's a lot more complicated is that this stuff all interacts fairly strongly in complicated ways with the interstellar medium. So the dark matter annihilates and it sends the stuff towards us. This stuff doesn't just come straight to us, it bounces around. For example, our galaxy has a magnetic field. There's also dust and starlight and all kinds of stuff for these things to run into. The magnetic fields tend to be the most important things, but there are also debris flows and all sorts of things. And to estimate the cosmic ray signals, we have to do two things. The first is the particle physics part of estimating what the actual dark matter signal is at the source. And then we need to take that source production rate and translate it and essentially evolve it to what we would see on Earth. So let me define, to start off with, a quantity that I'll call psi I of x and e. And what I mean by this is the number density of species I. And by species I mean one of these things. For unit energy, at the spatial point, x. So one of the assumptions that goes into the story is that our galaxy has reached essentially a steady state, so that on the average, the effect of dark matter annihilations at any point just gives some steady state flux of high energy particles. So this is that steady state flux, and it's actually differential. Sorry, this is the steady state density from those dark matter annihilations. This is the steady state number density per unit energy, and this is specifically the number density at the point where the dark matter is annihilating.
Yes. So this is at energy.
Yeah. So if you like, it's a differential number density. It's roughly dni de, which is a function of e, and also x. So we assume we have a steady state, and there are lots of contributions from dark matter. So this number density might come from dark matter annihilation at that point x. But there might also be contributions from dark matter annihilation at other points where this density has diffused or bounced around to get to point x. So the effect of all the annihilations throughout the galaxy are going to give some local number density per unit energy, psi in our galaxy. And what we want to compute is the value of psi at our location, where we're going to measure the stuff. And for that, we're going to have to compute the contributions to psi from dark matter annihilations all over the galaxy. So there's a differential equation for that. And that differential equation, which assumes that the galaxies reach a steady state, the differential equation that describes the evolution of this is a fairly straightforward form. It looks like a diffusion equation. And it's a local diffusion equation. So I'll write it out. And I'll try to explain what the pieces are. We're not going to try to solve it, but I want to give you an idea how you actually compute the density, this psi, at our location from all the other sources. The way you compute it is you solve this differential equation with boundary conditions set by the source. So this QI is the source, and it comes from dark matter annihilations. I'll come back to it in a second. So let me just write it out and then explain what the stuff is. Dz, z hat, vc, psi I, k, psi, del e, so this is our differential equation, and along the way, let me draw a picture of our galaxy. So this is a view of our galaxy head-on. Here's the galactic center. There's a galactic bulge out here. We're somewhere out over here. It's us, and we think there's a big dark matter halo all around. And the dark matter annihilation, in principle, can happen anywhere in the halo. So a dark matter annihilation happens, let's say, here. And we want to figure out what the contribution from annihilation is here and everywhere else in the halo corresponds to the value of psi we see at our location. So the point is that psi is described by this differential equation. And this qi is a source term. And the source term just comes from dark matter annihilation. And it's just 1/2 rho chi at point x over m chi squared times the annihilation cross section times this fi of e. And this fi of e, recall, is the mean number, the average number of I particles per unit energy with energy e per annihilation. So in other words, this fi is like dni de per annihilation. So it's the energy spectrum of the ith annihilation product. So this first term is a local source. So at any point x, I have an influx of cosmic rays of variety I from dark matter annihilation. So this is a source term. And all these terms describe diffusion effects. So these two pieces describe diffusion in these two terms describe diffusion, but this is diffusion in position space, and this corresponds to convection. So this part is, if you like, space diffusion. And the reason we think of it as space diffusion is that this piece is going to, if you like, give you a large energy if you have a large gradient in the density. So regions of large gradient like to spread out into even gradients. So this looks like diffusion. And the reason why you get diffusion is that, at least in the region of our galaxy, there's a magnetic field. But there's a magnetic field, but these magnetic fields are very turbulent. They're very random. And as a charged particle, especially these guys, bounce around in that turbulent magnetic field. They're going to scatter off the magnetic field and bounce around. So this induces diffusion. It mostly comes from magnetic fields. This piece is called convection. And the origin of the convection is that when I say the z direction, I mean the direction vertical from the plane. And what ends up happening is in the galactic disk, particularly in the galactic disk near us and all through the galactic disk, you have lots of complicated astrophysics happening. And one of the astrophysics things that can happen are that you have supernova shockwaves. You have stars essentially blowing up, producing shockwaves. And these shockwaves induce a net wind away from the galactic plane. So these shockwaves push these annihilation products along with it. And here, this VC corresponds to just some number times sine of z hat. So what I mean by this is VC points vertically away from the disk. And this is a convection effect from the fact that material is flowing out of the galactic disk from these shockwaves. And this material flowing out of the galactic disk from the shockwaves can interact with these products and carry them along with it. Yes.
So the supernovae don't happen very often, do they?
Yeah, but when you average everything over a very long time, you get a net outward flux. Yes.
So VC is a constant everywhere along the galactic plane?
Not exactly, but it turns out that for most of this stuff, we care mostly about the region fairly close to us.
Because like I would have expected, I guess, VC to be a function of X and Y, I suppose?
Or at least the kind of the axial distance from the galactic center. Which I think that's true in general. But since we're fairly far out from the galactic center and the galactic bulge, and it turns out that these things don't travel too far. We can just treat it as a constant relatively close to us. And I think the number of VC is something like 15 kilometers per second. The specific number doesn't matter, just that the physics of this is we have stuff flowing out of the galactic plane, and this carries the cosmic ray products along. And finally, this last piece corresponds to diffusion in momentum space. Diffusion in energy space. And what's going on here is that these cosmic ray particles can scatter off stuff. And when they scatter off stuff, a cosmic ray particle with a given energy might scatter to a higher energy or lower energy. But they can also circulate in the galactic magnetic field and give off energy to synchrotron radiation. So this term corresponds to, actually I should say really this term is energy diffusion. And this term corresponds to synchrotron radiation, where you lose energy to you lose energy from things like synchrotron, but also things like inverse compton scattering. So the point is we have some local differential equation for this number density. The particle physics input is essentially just this cross section times the Fi of E function. This is just the local dark matter density, and all of this stuff is really complicated astrophysics. So I'm telling you about this so you have an idea of how you'd actually compute this. In practice, there are nice computer codes that do it all for you. So in this diffusion equation, which I should say is also probably an oversimplification of what's actually going on, there's some coefficients. There's this VC coefficient. There's the K, the KEE, and the B loss. And these coefficients have significant uncertainties. But you can constrain them by doing various observations. And one of the observations that's useful is looking at heavy nuclei produced by astrophysical processes. And I won't go into that too much, but by looking at cosmic rays produced by astrophysical processes, you can constrain these parameters reasonably well. And once you constrain these parameters, you can go and solve for the differential flux of cosmic rays produced by dark matter, which are given by this. And there's some models for this. Now, what we want at the end of the day isn't so much this differential equation as we want the value of psi I at our location. And we can solve this using a Green's function. So the solution of this equation, in general, at any point x in any energy, can be written in the following form. Okay, so the way to solve this is you find a Green's function for the homogeneous part of the differential equation with qi set to 0, and then you convolve that Green's function with the source. So this is a solution to the homogeneous part where I put a delta function source. And then when I replace the delta function by an actual source, this should be an ES, by the actual source, I can get the solution of my equation in general. So you should think of this as a Green's function or a transfer function. And what it means physically is that the value of the flux at my location is given by the sources integrated over all possible points in the galaxy for the given source energy, convolved with this transfer function that tells me if I have a source at point X, S, and that produces particles with energy ES, how likely is that product to get to me at my location with an energy E? So this Green's function, again, it's a messy thing, but there's a numerical code called galprop that essentially computes it for you. So there are other codes too, but the most popular one is something called galprop. So in galprop, what you do is specify your source function, and it takes in effect a best fit value of the parameters in this diffusion equation, and it uses it to solve for this Green's function. It convolves it with QI, and it tells you what your value of the local density is. Now, there's a way to, this is a local number density. What we actually measure is a local flux. So let me just look at what I want to do. The local flux, this is the thing we want to measure, phi for species I at our location, which corresponds essentially to the energy of the sun, the location of the sun with given energy. The local flux is just v over 4 pi times psi I. Local cosmic ray flux. This is the thing we measure in our telescope. And I can rewrite this in the form that, again, like we did for gamma rays, splits off the particle physics from splits off the particle physics from the astrophysics. So this v is a local dark matter velocity. This is our local velocity. This is our velocity through the galactic disk. This part is particle physics. And this stuff, or at least this stuff, is all the astrophysics. And this thing specifically is just a trivial rewriting of what I had before. It's just integral over source positions, gi, dot, 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 convolved with the dark matter density at point at the source, divided by the local density in our region. Okay. So in any case, this whole business of computing the local cosmic ray flux for the I species, it's just a matter of essentially finding the annihilation rate and convolving it with the dark matter density at the source and the propagation from the source to us. So that's the whole story. Doing this in practice is complicated, but you should understand at least all the bits and pieces that go into the computation. So let me now... this is the result. Let me move on next to talking about what we actually see. But just a very quick summary for different species. Protons and antiprotons propagate very efficiently. So they travel a reasonable distance. Electrons and positrons don't propagate so well. And if we see an electron or positron cosmic ray, it's likely to have come from a dark matter annihilation within about a kiloparsec from us. So the electron-positron propagation is fairly local. Proton-antiproton works better. Things like nuclei are more complicated. But in any case, these are the things we look for primarily. Protons and antiprotons, and electrons and antielectrons. And one thing we can also say is, one other thing about these is there are astrophysical backgrounds. So there are also positrons produced by astrophysics, and antiprotons produced by astrophysics. So for these backgrounds, we expect lots of protons and lots of electrons. But from dark matter annihilation, you typically expect equal numbers of protons and antiprotons, or electrons and antielectrons, just because the dark matter doesn't carry a net baryon number or doesn't carry any net electric charge. So the backgrounds for antiprotons are going to be high-energy proton-proton collisions. They produce proton-antiproton pairs. And the background for electrons can come from things like you could have a proton hit a hydrogen atom to produce something plus a pi plus. And the pi plus can decay through various stages to an e plus plus some neutrinos. So there are various astrophysical sources of antielectrons and antiprotons, but we expect these astrophysical sources to be less than the dark matter, the relative dark matter ratio of antiprotons or antielectrons. So the thing experiments look for typically are excesses of antiprotons or excesses of antielectrons relative to what you would expect from astrophysics. So this is a calculational story. Let me tell you what the current state of the art is in terms of direct searches. And there's actually an interesting story here. Let's see. So let me start off with electrons and positrons. So yes?
Why do you expect less production from the astrophysical part than from dark matter?
Sorry?
Why do you expect less production of protons and antiprotons from the astrophysical part?
Oh, sorry. It's not the overall production. It's the ratio of matter to antimatter. So most of the astrophysical cosmic rays come from just taking particles you have lying around and accelerating them through some process. So the astrophysical cosmic rays are mostly electrons and protons.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, probably something that you can measure, no? You can say, what is the ratio of this process in comparison with the ratio of that matter?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'll get to next. But I'm saying that, so you measure some data, and you want to compare data to predictions from astrophysics. And if you see more stuff in the data than you have from your predictions, this suggests there might be another source like dark matter. So in terms of predictions from astrophysics predicts that you have mostly protons and mostly electrons with much smaller fractions of antiprotons and antielectrons, whereas dark matter cosmic rays would have equal numbers of them. So actually, I'll get to it right now. The thing that the most experiments look for are ratios of antimatter to matter in terms of cosmic ray fluxes. So for E plus and E minus, there's an interesting story from an experiment called Pamela. And what Pamela measured was the flux of positrons divided by the total positron plus electron flux. So this quantity is expected to be small for astrophysics, but it should approach 1/2 for dark matter annihilation. And what the Pamela experiment has seen for this quantity has gotten a lot of people very excited. So they make a plot of this fraction versus the energy in GeV. So they have some differential flux per unit energy that they plot as a function of energy. And what you expect from astrophysics is just some following function. So this is, let's say, you're up to sort of 0.2 here. And down here, you're like 0.02. And this is like 1 GeV. This is like 10 GeV. This is like 100 GeV. So the astrophysical expectation is this dashed line. And the astrophysical expectation is that you have much more matter than antimatter. So this ratio is small. What they see in terms of data, though, is the data tracks more or less the astrophysical expectation at low energies. But going to higher energies, they see an upturn. And their data goes up to about 100 GeV. So there's some error bars on this, but even within the error bars, it's clear that there's a significant excess. So a lot of people are very excited about this. This excess is seen by Pamela, and it was confirmed by Fermi. And a lot of people have tried to interpret this as a signal of dark matter. So it turns out that a dark matter interpretation is a little bit tricky, and I'll come back to this in a minute. But let me just mention quickly also that actually this morning, probably in about 15 minutes, an experiment called AMS2 is going to release the results of an improved search for this quantity. And hopefully that this new data will go out to higher energies. And we'll probably find out in maybe 45 minutes what they actually see. So if you go and you look up AMS2, you should be able to find a link to the web conference. So hopefully they'll see something new and very exciting. So I'll come back to a dark matter interpretation of this in a minute. The second
in 15 minutes, there's a live broadcast in space room.
Okay. So people can go to the space room. The first 15 minutes will probably be people just talking about the satellite and the detector. So the interesting stuff, you'll probably have time to get to the interesting part after class. Okay, so anyway, this is the E plus E minus result, and we see a nice excess. And you might expect that that if we see an excess in anti-electrons, we should also see an excess in anti-protons. This isn't quite the case. Pamela also looked at the antiproton to proton ratio as a function of energy. And what they see is what you expect from astrophysics is something that looks like this. What they see in their data seems to match up very well. This is like 1 GeV, seems to match up very well with the astrophysical expectation. So this is a bit of a puzzle. Why should there only be an excess in anti-electrons, but no excess in anti-protons? The other slightly tricky part about interpreting the Pamela result in terms of dark matter is the actual dark matter annihilation rate you need to explain this upturn. So the annihilation rate you need to explain the upturn, you can work that out. The cross section you need to interpret this as dark matter annihilation is pretty big. It's something like 10 to the minus 25 centimeters cubed per second for dark matter mass of about 100 GeV. And I have to modify the effect of cross-section by the relative branching fraction, the relative fraction of the annihilations that go into leptons. So remember, the Pamela result C is electrons. So if none of your annihilations go into electrons, you need a higher cross-section to accommodate it. So this is puzzling because, for example, if you wanted thermal dark matter, we should have instead about 3 times 10 to the minus 26. So the thermal annihilation cross-section to give the right dark matter density is quite a lot smaller than this value, about a factor of 3. The other thing, so the first puzzle is that this is pretty big. The second puzzle is that because we don't see an excess in antiprotons, the dark matter annihilation should go almost entirely to leptons. Because if a lot of the dark matter annihilations go to hadronic stuff, like quarks or gluons, these quarks and gluons are going to hadronize into pions and protons and antiprotons, and we would also expect to see an excess here. So the fact that there's no excess here means that the dark matter annihilation should go almost entirely to leptons. And this is also a bit surprising, because at least in naive models of dark matter annihilation, you tend to get fairly democratic annihilation modes into leptons, either directly or indirectly, and hadronic stuff. So the first puzzle is a big cross-section. The second puzzle is the annihilation almost entirely into leptons. And the third puzzle is that if we do have a big annihilation rate, if we do have a big annihilation rate in our galaxy, this implies that we also expect to see gamma rays. So the big annihilation rate that you would need to explain the Pamela result with dark matter means that if this is dark matter, you should also get a big cosmic ray signal, a big gamma ray signal. But as I mentioned yesterday, there's no obvious big gamma ray signal from either the galactic center or from the galactic center or from dwarf soils or what else. So it's a bit tricky to accommodate all of these requirements within a model of dark matter, where you get a big annihilation cross-section that goes almost entirely to leptons, and it doesn't produce very many gamma rays. So people have tried all kinds of theories to do this. There's one that seems to kind of work. So let me just mention that one very quickly. And the one that seems to work is a dark matter annihilation. So here's my dark matter annihilation into particles that I'll call phi. So suppose our dark matter annihilates into some new particle that I call phi. And then these particles are somewhat metastable, but they're also light. And these light particles then decay at some later time to leptons. So the reason this is nice for two reasons. The first is that if these particles are very light, m phi less than roughly 2 m pi, this means that there's no problem with there's no excess of antiprotons. And this fact also helps with producing fewer gamma rays. So if this state that the dark matter annihilates into subsequently decays into leptons, and these and this state is very light, just through kinematics, you can't annihilate into antiprotons, for one. And second of all, if you're very light, you also avoid producing too many gamma rays, because one source of gamma rays is a decay pi zero to gamma gamma. So a very light state like this can deal with problems 2 and 3. And it also helps with problem 1. So it turns out that when dark matter annihilates into a light state. And if this light state also if this light state also mediates an attractive force between the dark matter, what can happen is that at low velocities, the dark matter annihilation can be enhanced. So the idea is that if I have two dark matter particles that are moving very slowly, as they are in our galaxy today, if there's an attractive force between them, these slowly moving dark matter particles will be attracted to each other, even if they're initially separated. So this means that it's easier for dark matter particles to find each other at low velocities than at high velocities. And the upshot of that is that you can get a larger annihilation rate today, where the effective velocity is low, compared to the annihilation rate at freeze-out, where the velocity is typically much higher. So having these light particles around can give you this enhancement of the cross-section today. This is called a Sommerfeld enhancement. And the idea of the Sommerfeld enhancement is that we can have a large annihilation rate today with low-velocity dark matter relative to what the annihilation rate would be at freeze-out. So the Sommerfeld enhancement is a low-velocity enhancement that can give a higher sigma v today than it would at freeze-out. So we can still have thermal dark matter, but have a higher annihilation rate through Sommerfeld. In some sense, this is kind of the opposite of the P-wave cross-sections. So for a P-wave cross-section, the cross-section is proportional to velocity squared and actually goes down. It actually decreases at low velocity. This does just the opposite because of an attractive force. So the Pomelo story is still up in the air. It's hard to accommodate it within a model of theories of dark matter, but there are some seemingly viable candidates. Hopefully we'll learn some more today in the webcast of the AMS-2 results. But I should also mention that there are plausible astrophysical explanations for the Pomelo excess. Now, one of the astrophysical proposals is that pulsars could give you an anti-electron excess. And the idea here is a pulsar is it's a system involving a neutron star. We have really, really big magnetic fields. And these magnetic fields can accelerate charged particles. And at least naively, you'd only expect particles sitting around to be accelerated. So you'd only expect them to contribute to the electron flux, not the positron flux. But it's been suggested that maybe you could have a pair creation in the very high magnetic field in pulsars. And the positrons that get created that way get accelerated and produce positron cosmic rays. Now, since it's much harder to pair produce an antiproton, you also wouldn't expect an antiproton excess. And because these would be coming from pulsar, you wouldn't expect too much of a gamma ray excess. So there's also a possible astrophysical explanation, which is pulsars. People have also suggested that maybe we just don't understand the diffusion equation here enough, and that there are also diffusion effects. There are transport effects that can create an upturn. But in any case, it's something we're still studying. And what we really want is, I guess, another hint of cosmic ray dark matter. And we're still waiting for that. But we'll have to see what AMS-2 says. Okay, so let me just mention two other things quickly. This is indirect detection from gamma rays. You can also have indirect dark matter signals that are even more indirect than this. So the idea here is that we're seeing the products of dark matter annihilation directly, fairly directly. But the products of the dark matter annihilation can also do things that could be observable in other ways. So I'm calling this indirect detection. And let me give you two examples. So the first example is in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And the story for the cosmic microwave background radiation is that what we see is these 3 Kelvin photons, where are the photons left over from when the universe became transparent to radiation. So what happened, let me turn this, when the age of the universe was about 1100, free protons and electrons combined to form neutral hydrogen. So what happens is you go from a cosmological plasma of charged particles to to a cosmological plasma of neutral things. And this happens fairly quickly. This is called recombination. It's a bit of a bad name because these things weren't combined at any earlier point, but it's called recombination. And the point is that the universe, before recombination, was opaque to photons. Photons traveling through a plasma of charged particles hit those charged particles and bounce around and don't go very far. But as soon as the charged stuff combined into neutral stuff, the interaction with photons became much weaker. And all of a sudden, photons could essentially travel as long as they, just about as long as they could possibly want without hitting anything. So all of a sudden, at Z of 1100, the universe becomes transparent. And the photons left over from when this happens are what we see as the cosmic microwave background. So if we're sitting here at if you like, the center of the universe, there's some spherical surface around this that corresponds to where photons were emitted at this redshift are just reaching us. So there's some distance where the photon that was emitted when the universe became transparent at 1100 reaches us now. And these photons are what we see as a cosmic microwave background. And what can happen from dark matter annihilation is that the photons at this point have some average temperature, and they have some density fluctuations and some behavior. What can happen is that when dark matter annihilates, dark matter annihilation can dump energy into this plasma recombination. And dumping energy into the plasma at recombination can modify the properties of the cosmic microwave background. So the values, the cosmological parameters and their relationship can be modified by energy dumps at recombination. And it's especially sensitive to energy dumping at recombination. And the upshot is that given the fact that our basic cosmological model fits the CMB data very well, we're not allowed to have big deviations from it. And this constrains how much energy I can dump from dark matter annihilation into it. So the net effect is that at recombination, I have a limit on the annihilation cross section. I have a limit on the annihilation cross section of dark matter from this energy dumping of about 3 × 10⁻²⁵ centimeters cubed per second divided by F. And it's linear in the dark matter mass. Actually, I think this might be squared, but I need to double check that. But in any case, I get stronger limits from lighter dark matter particles just because there are more of them around to make up the relic density. And this F is an efficiency factor. So you can think of this as it's a factor by which the dark matter annihilation products mess up the cosmic microwave background. So different annihilation products can do more damage than others. So I'm lumping all that particle physics detail into this F factor. But in any case, you get nice limits. You get pretty strong limits on dark matter annihilation from the CMB. And this is one way that dark matter annihilation can be potentially probed indirectly. So it's indirect detection, but indirect detection. This is the first example. The second example is what I'm going to call synchrotron emission. And the idea here is that, so here's our galaxy, and here's the galactic center. Near the galactic center, there's a big magnetic field. And if I start pumping in high energy charged particles, let's say from dark matter annihilation, so I've got my dark matter annihilation here, and let's say I produce an electron or something here. The electron is charged, is going to start circulating in the magnetic field. And when my high energy charged particle starts circulating in the magnetic field, it's going to give off radiation in the terms of in the form of photons. So a Bremsstrahlung wing, if you like. So given the size of the magnetic field, and assuming that I have energies in the range of, let's say, 10 to 100 GeV, you expect photons to be given off by synchrotron to have a frequency of about sort of in the gigahertz range. So this is kind of microwave radio wave frequencies. And people look at the center of the galaxy in these wavelengths, and they see some net flux. What's interesting is that if you look at cosmic microwave background data, these cosmic microwave background photons are also measured in similar frequency bands. And one of the things you have to do when you measure these would-be primordial photons is you have to subtract off all of the emission from astrophysical stuff in the corresponding wavelengths. So people spend a lot of time removing this radio frequency stuff, which mostly comes from hot dust being accelerated around and radiating off. And what they find is that after you strip off what you think is the astrophysics, there's some remnant. And there's a remnant radio frequency the remnant of radio frequency radiation near the galactic center. And this is called the WMAP haze, because it first came from subtracting off dust maps for WMAP. And this excess has also been interpreted as dark matter, a synchrotron emission from dark matter. So the idea is you have lots of dark matter near the galactic center. It annihilates. It produces electrons one way or another. These electrons circulate in the magnetic field, give off radio frequency radiation. And this excess, the WMAP haze, is coming from that. But a lot of people argue about this because there are also big astrophysical uncertainties. Okay. So this is everything I wanted to say about indirect detection. And I'm going to change gears now to something that's also kind of indirect detection, but is maybe even a bit more indirect. And the next thing I want to cover is the effect of dark matter and stars. So dark matter can be captured on a star. And when it's captured on a star, it tends to sink to the middle of the star and form a density there. And when it does so, the density builds up and it can start annihilating. And this can start heating up the star and modifying how the star operates. One very special case that I'll cover in a little bit of detail is the sun. And specifically in the sun, dark matter can annihilate, produce neutrinos, and we can look for those neutrinos in neutrino experiments. So before I start, I've got a few minutes. Let me just tell you very quickly how stars work. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, but as a particle physicist, it's not something I learned in my early education, but it's kind of a fun story. So I'll just go through it quickly, but I'll give you the idea. So the idea of a star is I have a ball of gas. So I have a ball of neutral gas. So we expect it'll be mostly hydrogen and helium to start with, because those are the most common elements in the universe. And this ball of gas is going to attract itself from gravity. And as this ball of gas is attracting itself, is self-gravitating, the stuff in the gas is going to start getting compressed. But as you compress the gas, it's going to heat up. And if you compress the gas enough, it's going to heat up enough that you can start sparking nuclear fusion reactions. So you get compression from gravitational interaction. And this leads up to heating. And if the initial ball of gas is big enough, this heating can become so hot that you end up getting fusion reactions with hydrogen. So these fusion reactions eventually take hydrogen molecules, or hydrogen nuclei, and fuse them through a multi-step process into helium-4. And this fusion reaction releases a fair bit of energy. And what you get if you wait long enough is the gravitational pressure from attraction is stabilized by the thermal pressure from the heating and the energy dumped by fusion. And you reach a steady state where the energy that I release through starlight, through radiative emission, is exactly balanced by the energy, essentially the energy released by the fusion reactions. So stars, if you like, are this balance between gravitational push and thermal pressure from the fusion reactions. And okay, this is the very basic story that you probably know. But what actually happens specifically is pretty interesting. The most common type of star is a so-called main sequence star. And the main sequence of stellar evolution corresponds to burning hydrogen. And by burning, I mean fusing it into helium. So in a main sequence, the hydrogen is fusing into helium. Our sun is an example of this case. Our sun is a main sequence star. Let me also mention that for stars, we usually write their masses in units of the solar mass. And the solar mass is roughly 2 times 10 to the 30 kilos. So our sun's a fairly typical main sequence star. And main sequence stars tend to be fairly similar, with the main difference just being the total size of the star. And it turns out that the bigger the star, the faster, the higher the temperature in the core, and the faster they burn. So even though there's more material, bigger clumps, bigger stars, burn faster and end up using up their fuel faster than smaller stars. So the main sequence of stellar evolution goes on for, well, typically a long time. In the case of our sun, the main sequence lifetime is about 10 billion years. The age of our sun is about 5 billion years, so we have lots of time left. But if you wait long enough, you leave the main sequence. And leaving the main sequence happens when you run out of hydrogen in the core. And when you run out of hydrogen in the core, what happens is that you essentially run out of fusion reactions, and the stuff around the core collapses on itself. And when it collapses on itself, it's going to heat up further. And the heating might be enough to start helium fusion. But helium fusion isn't so easy. So what tends to happen is instead of helium fusion, your core collapses until it's stabilized by electron degeneracy pressure, so just a regular Fermi pressure. And when this happens, your collapsing core bounces on itself and rebounds. And the rebound pushes out the material on the outside. But it also creates a shock wave that creates very high temperatures going out. And the shock wave can start to ignite hydrogen burning outside the core. And depending on what happens, for small stars, for small stars less than about half a solar mass, what happens is that this bounce doesn't reignite. Doesn't reignite the hydrogen fusion. Instead, for small stars, you just get a central core that's basically inert, supported by the electron degeneracy pressure. Degeneracy. And around this core, you have you blow off all the envelope, all the outer material, and this forms essentially a cloud of hot dust called a planetary nebula. So you get the central core that's basically inert plus a planetary nebula. But if you're heavier than about half a solar mass, I'll call this a medium-sized star. So a medium star is half a solar mass to up to about 10 solar masses. What happens is you ignite a shell of hydrogen burning. And this shell of hydrogen burning is going to expand a bit. And this burning shell of hydrogen with a fairly inert core is called a red giant. So in a red giant star, instead of the core burning hydrogen, you have a shell burning hydrogen with an inert core. Now eventually for a red giant, what happens is you're going to run out of hydrogen in the shell. And in this case, you have another collapse. And this other collapse may bounce you into this inert case, where you have an inert core with a planetary nebula. Or if it's violent enough, it's actually going to start igniting helium. So when you start igniting helium, what happens in this case is you produce what's called an asymptotic giant star, and you start a helium fusion. And once you run out of helium in the core, you have another bounce, and you may end up again in this sort of end state with a core that's inert, supported by electron degeneracy pressure in a planetary nebula, or you might start fusing heavier elements like carbon and oxygen and so on. So each step, they're different paths. And typically, unless the star is very heavy, you're going to end up with an inert core in a planetary nebula. But if a very large star, what can happen is that your heavy star can start fusing stuff all the way up to iron. So specifically iron 56. And so you have the cycle where you start fusing heavier and heavier elements. Once you get to iron 56, though, it turns out that you're done. So if you look at the amount of binding energy, the binding energy per nucleon within types of nuclei, the maximum binding energy per nuclei happens to occur in iron 56. For nuclei heavier than that, the binding energy per nucleus per nucleon goes down. And this means that for nuclei lighter than iron, you can gain energy by fusion. But for nuclei heavier than iron, you can gain energy by fission, where the nuclei splits up into smaller things. But the upshot of this is that by the time you get to iron, and you go through this bounce procedure, when I run out of iron in the core and things collapse, when the core becomes iron, everything collapses, but it collapses very violently. And if the collapse is violent enough, the electron degeneracy pressure won't be enough to support it. And the collapse might go even further, and it might be supported by neutron degeneracy pressure. So at very high pressures, electrons and protons combine into neutrons. And if you're supported by the neutron degeneracy pressure, you get a really big bounce. And this really big bounce is what we call a supernova explosion. And in the supernova explosion, the conditions are so violent that you can actually start putting together elements heavier than iron to make stuff that's even heavier by fusion into stuff that's even heavier than iron. So basically, all the elements that we know of that are heavier than iron were created in these supernova shocks. Stuff up to iron was typically created by stellar burning. And what else? If the central core is even too big, not even the neutron degeneracy pressure can support it, and you'll just end up as a black hole. So there's a whole story of types of stars depending on where they are in their evolution. And you have different endpoints. But let me mention in passing that this degenerate core supported by electron degeneracy pressure is called a white dwarf. And a white dwarf is, if you feel like, just a ball of stuff supported by the electron degeneracy pressure. And it's fairly inert. And more or less, it just cools off as it ages. So it doesn't do much. It just sits around. Finally, a neutron star. A neutron star is a bundle of stuff supported by neutron degeneracy pressure. And these things are actually turned out to be very, very interesting for nuclear physicists and people who study hadrons. And neutron stars are essentially the densest things we know of. A typical neutron star will have the mass of a sun, collapsed into a radius of about 10 kilometers. So just really incredibly dense objects. And the neutron stars, at least for the most part, just sit around and cool off. So anyway, this is my lightning introduction to what how stars work. Tomorrow I'll say a few more things about what happens when I put dark matter into stars, in these different types of stars. And I'll also get on a little bit to looking for dark matter in colliders. I think that's everything for now. And I guess, is it the gravity room for the MS2 or space?
It's space.
Space. Okay. Where is that? Is that straight fourth floor? Okay. Anyway, I'm going to run off to that. Yeah. But.